So we've been talking about modern popular amusements. Elvis Presley was a modern phenomenon. The Beatles were a modern phenomenon. I've tried to explain to you how that works and the way that technology, demographics, meaning and value play into popular culture with an exhortation of helping your students, I'm a teacher, I often say students, your kids read these things. But the thesis statement to kick me off here is to suggest to you that there will never be another Beatlemania. There will never be another Michael Jackson, the king of pop, because we're moving into post-modernity. And so the landscape that I just described to you is a landscape that is in the process of eroding, and it's eroding very quickly. The modern world, the modern phenomenon, its technological infrastructure upon which it was built that emerged in the 19th century with modernity is eroding, and it really started eroding in the 1990s, and then with a number of factors, the breakup of the Soviet Union and the position of the United States, interestingly, on the world stage, the advent of the internet, which is very significant, and then some of the developments that I'm talking about that relate to this graph here and smartphones. But I don't think we can understand where we are unless we understand also where we've been. And so I've been talking about modernity, but I want to explain to you why there's never going to be a Beatles again. Okay? And I don't think you should expect it. And I want to point to some interesting things that have been developing over the past 15, 20 years that a lot of people who didn't come of age in the last 15 or 20 years, a lot of people who are of parenting age, aren't necessarily aware of or cognizant of. And it has to do with the effects of the smartphones and the isolation of the consumption of cultural material, happening in isolation in a way that is really unique. And it's got widespread ramifications. One of the things that I think we are all aware of is, and I began with this last night, with how sexual practices are becoming more widely and widely accepted, practices that previously had been taboo. And overt displays of sexuality. You would think that today, then, would be the best heyday, the no-holds-barred, palace-on days of sexual experience. But that's not true. Sociologists refer to our current era as an era of a sex recession. Young people are having sex much less than they used to. And that's a documented, well-understood fact, which is curious because this is arising when the openness to sexual contact and the taboos that might be a governor on it, the taboos have eroded, the openness has expanded. You'd think, once again, that this should be a heyday, when it's not the case. This is college students here from 2000 to 2018. This is pretty well documented and uncontroversial, but high schooler sexual activity. So if you go back to the 1990s, that top bar is people who have actually had sexual intercourse, and the lower bar is those who, at the time of the survey, are currently in a sexual relationship. Okay, so of course the top bar is going to be more. But you'll notice that in the late 1990s, we moved from, over half to less than half of high school kids that had sex. Okay, and that trend has continued and is continuing. And well, in many respects, that's a good thing. Okay, that's a good thing. But how do we understand and account for this? Well, here's something that's also interesting. Google has been around for the last, you know, dozen or so years, and its algorithms, interesting, searches related to sex have increased. The number of searches, so it's just one data point. This is from the 10 years, 2004 to 2014. Google searches for should I have sex and then fill in the blank. Is those searches are increasing number, or does the pill blank, those searches are increased. This is over the same decade, 04 to 14. Best condoms, 04 to 14. You see it's all on the rise. These are, does sex cause, you know, of course it starts back from before Google searches and then more and more instances of these searches. And this is calibrated. It's not just the raw number of searches. It's the searches per user. It's calibrated for the number of searches. You can't account for it simply by saying more people are doing Google searches, in other words, right? It's a proportion of Google searches that are using these words when a Google search is used. All right. So, wait a minute. Why is it that we have this openness to sexuality, an open curiosity about sexuality, openness, an increased interest in sexuality, and yet a decreasing experience in actually having sex? A decreasing experience in actually having sex. Well, the answer comes back to those iPhones. Basically because young people are more and more losing their ability to interact with other human beings in real time and in real space. And this is pretty well understood. Because they now have these devices that can open them up to connections, and connections that they are increasingly more and more substituting for real-world connections with real human beings. And I'm not talking about whether connections are healthy or unhealthy, and I would suggest to you that, sexual contact out of marriage is unhealthy, and we would agree with that, right? So we're talking about a decline in something that's unhealthy, but I would suggest to you that this decline in something that's unhealthy is brought about by something further back in the framework is more deeply unhealthy. More deeply unhealthy, and that is that students or young people just don't know how to, young men don't know how to deal with an actual young woman. That's the reason. And of course, they will substitute their experience with the young woman with the increasing proliferation of a sexual experience substitute in the form of pornography, and so they don't have to deal with a real human being. They don't have to deal with a real human being. Interesting studies show this. There was one study, I found this one particularly interesting here, an intriguing study that went county by county, a study of the arrival of broadband internet from 1999 to 2007, through the 90s, and this study was undertaken by area code, where broadband goes to different regions, becomes available to different places geographically in the United States, found a distinct correlation between the arrival of the internet and a decline of teen sexual behavior. Our results suggest that increased broadband access explains at least 7% of the decline of the teen birth rate between 1999 and 2007. Teen births, teen pregnancy is on the decline, as you might expect too, closely associated with this. We who came of age in the 1980s, 1990s might be surprised to hear this, because the moral deterioration that we've experienced would suggest that, oh, they're hooking up more and more and more. And that's factually just not true. but it's because they're not even connecting with anyone. That's the reason why. They're not connecting with anyone. And it's actually overcoming the absence of any moral prohibition against it. All right. In order to understand how this... Will I get pregnant? That's another one here. Boyfriend cheating. There's another one. These searches. In order to understand this new landscape, I want to talk about an insight that was identified back in 2004 by a guy named Chris Anderson that's become widely understood since that time, which is the phenomenon of the long tail. And this is going to characterize the new marketplace that we're in, the new marketplace of commerce that we're in. And it has to do with what I was describing earlier about the mainstream and margin dynamic. And the short story of it is basically this, that we're losing the sense of mainstream where everything is becoming marginal to the point of where everything is niche and there's an absence of a mainstream altogether. An absence of a mainstream altogether. A shared experience of listening to Michael Jackson or something like that. If I could run a thought experiment out with you, if you were to take my students at New St. Andrews College, a room full of 20-year-olds today, and you would have them, each of them, list their top five artists who are putting out music now. Okay, the top five current artists. And they all throughout the room list their top five and then run that same thought experiment about when I was in high school or maybe where you were in high school. So everyone in your high school class, everyone's going to put down their top five artists. Back when you were in high school, there probably would have been a lot of fighting and arguing over those lists. Oh, that person's stupid. I hate that person. This person's better than that person. That sort of thing. And you can imagine how the conversation might proceed. Right? Today, and this is actually true, three out of the five artists on the list would be people that no one else in the room has heard of. And they couldn't even have the conversation. The difference is not that there was an agreement over who's the best versus now there's contest over who's the best. Back when I was in high school, that would have been contest, you know, oh, you like that music, I hate that music. When I was coming of age, Michael Jackson was a big deal. That didn't mean that everyone liked Michael Jackson, but everyone would position themselves in relation to Michael Jackson because he was just there. And it was a shared point of reference, right? And today, we're lacking those shared points of reference because we're all off our niches. The mainstream no longer is there. And there will no longer be a Beatles because the Beatles arise in a world of the mainstream marginal dynamics. And there's no cultural space for something like that to occupy so many people's attention. Okay. So, why is that? How did that come about? And now I want to come back to explain here the long tail. Now, in the world of mainstream marginal dynamic, this is before e-commerce, back when we actually used to shop at brick-and-mortar stores. Remember those days when we used to shop at brick-and-mortar? And if you're going to buy music, you're going to a record store or a CD store, something like that. Well, if you go to the CD store on the corner or to your Tower Records or something like that, in order to justify that music selection to occupy a place in the stock, a proprietor, in order to make any money, had to sell probably about 3 units per year of that item. Otherwise, it's wasted space in the stock. But the same rule, economic rule, applied to a book in a bookstore. Okay? You know, there's only so many books that you can fit on the shelves in your bookstore and put up for sale, right? And you're not going to put a bunch of duds up there because you're not going to sell any. So the books that you would stock, in order for it to earn its rent on the shelf, you'd need to sell like 3 a year or more. Then you might stock it, right? And then there would be the Harry Potters. Maybe you're going to sell, in a given bookstore, you might sell 100 of those a year. But, then you've got the bestseller, and then the next bestseller, and then the next bestseller, and then the next bestseller. This is what this graph is imagining here. You've got the bestseller, and then the next bestseller, and then the next bestseller, that sort of thing. And you're going to go to, maybe the top few thousand books that are going to be available in your brick-and-mortar store, and then you lose the stock. You're selling the hits, and you can't make any money off of the misses. The hits and misses. Make sense? Same with movies. So in order to justify showing a movie in the economics of movies, if you're going to have a 2-week run to occupy that screen space in the theater, you need to have about 1,500 people come and see that movie. If you show up for 2 weeks and 3 people show up, you're losing money, right? You need to get 1,500 people to show up to justify it. And if it's really popular, a longer run, that sort of thing, right? Now, how many people? You need to have 1,500 people to watch Tom Cruise in Top Gun within probably a 10 or 15 mile radius of that movie theater. Okay. Now, here's something by way of contrast. In, around the year 2000, 20, 21 years ago, there were a lot of people who were immigrants from India here in the United States. In fact, there were millions of them. And there were a lot of Hindi movies, Bollywood movies, that have been created. And, in fact, there are millions of people who are in the United States who might be interested in watching that. But are there enough of them around Oregon City, Oregon, to justify the screen space of showing that movie? No. No. Just like, readers of certain books, you might find enough Harry Potter readers around within a 10-mile radius of your bookstore to justify stocking Harry Potter. But there are all kinds of books that you would not stock. In fact, a diligent bookstore person, a bookstore owner, would cull, if a title's been there for a year and hasn't sold, it's going on the cheap, I got to get rid of it to put something else that will sell in the shelves. Same with the CDs, same with movie screens, that sort of thing. But there probably are, there's the books that I buy, for example. There's probably, maybe 2 other people within a 100-mile radius that might be interested in the same book that I actually buy. And so it will never be stocked in a brick-and-mortar bookstore, right? But I can get it now. I can get it. And you know how I get it, because I shop online. Well, what's happened with Amazon and with other streaming services here is that you do have the top sellers and the next top sellers and the next top sellers, and you can get your Harry Potters from Amazon, but you can also get anything you want. And if you're not limited by the space restrictions of brick and mortar, you've got, remember what I said about Bollywood? You've got millions of Hindi-speaking people around the United States, just not enough to show them on the screen in your neighborhood theater. But if you can stream it, then you can have 1 million customers. And Amazon actually makes more money off of the misses than the hits. In other words, the area under the long tail is larger than the area of the bestsellers. And their business model is built on selling more down the long. They actually sell more units of things, of which they only sell a couple of items of. They sell more of the misses in the aggregate than they do in the collection of the hits. And that's what the long tail is, and that's the world in which we live. welcome to the world of streaming. E-commerce tends to do that. Back when I was listening to music, you're limited to the radio dial and the physical infrastructure of a brick-and-mortar store. You only have so many options. People are going to have different tastes, but they're going to be a point of reflection, these bestsellers, right? The best-selling hits. But we've moved into a world where commerce has reprogrammed itself, and they sell more misses than they sell hits, and they know it. And business models are fashioned that way. And it changes the way our young people experience their own world. They stream TV shows that maybe their friends haven't heard of. And they watch them at times when their friends are not watching them. Or maybe they'll stream a TV show today that their friend watched a year and a half ago. It's not a shared experience, is it? Everyone is moving down the long tail. That's what the long tail is. Welcome to the postmodern world. It's created an environment, once again, where we no longer have a mainstream. Innovation still happens, and innovation still comes from borrowing, but it's niches mixing with other niches rather than mainstream and margins. Little tribal interests mixing with other tribal interests, so you're going to see change in innovation still happening. Now, what we all habitually learn to do as we start to navigate and curate this for ourselves is, and you know this, if you want to buy shoes and you go onto the internet, would you type shoes into the search engine? Why not? You'll get a million hits, and maybe two out of those million you're interested in. Right? Okay. And so you're going to type in women's shoes. If you want women's shoes. Women's red shoes. Women's red. Actually, I'm getting into feminine footwear here. But you probably know. You would actually probably put in a whole sentence in that search engine to get something that you want, right? To get something that you want. We've trained ourselves to work this way, to target what we want. And business people understand this here. So if you've got, shoes, if someone types in shoes, that's going to have high yield. And if I am an advertiser who wants, like someone who does shoes and searches for shoes, would I want to put my shoe ad, show my shoe ad to that person? Probably not. It'll go before a lot of people. It'll go before a whole lot of people, and therefore that ad will be costly. And it'll have really low return, like high investment, low return. So if I'm an advertiser, I want to put my little niche product to the little niche searcher, and I'll have a high likelihood of securing that customer. Hasn't it been creepy when you start to see the ads pop up and you say, I actually want that. They know me. You know what I mean? They learn your personality, that sort of thing. And the way we work in the internet, we're increasingly rewarded for becoming more unlike others. And for we're trained to make our interests discreet, and that gets rewarded by we latch on to the things that we want, and we find the things that we want independently of other people. In fact, it actually is reinforced to make it more differentiated from other people. That's why we're not having a mainstream. See how this mechanism plays out. And so young people increasingly today become the creators of their own tastes rather than slipping into a mainstream, because a mainstream doesn't exist anymore. Your children are not being born into a world where there is Beatlemania, because it relies on the existence of a mainstream. your children are being born into a world where they chase down their own rabbit hole, which will be different than someone else's rabbit hole, which will be different yet than someone else's rabbit hole. Oftentimes it'll be titillating and interesting to them, and yet disconnecting them more and more from real people. Disconnecting them more and more from actual experiences and the experience with other people. They listen to music that's not the same music as their neighbor listens to, their friend listens to. Their, you know, friends might share Spotify lists, and they share Spotify lists because they're very different, right? And so that's how the streaming environment works, and it's not the world that I came of age in. I came of age into a world of Madonna and Michael Jackson. And kids these days don't live in a world of Madonna and Michael Jackson. Nothing like it at all. It's a world of self-curation, and it reinforces, and its gravitational pull is to separate you from other people. And the interface is something that separates you from other people right here. That is the world that we live in, and it's a world that creates young people who don't know how to talk to other people. You know, the sleazy young people don't even know how to bed another sleazy, you know, some sleazy guy doesn't know how to get a sleazy girl to bed. Lost the ability to do that because they're not playing together in the sandbox anymore. Because it's all mediated through here. So this is a world of selfies, and it's interesting to see then the music that it generates. And I will turn to our music here. Once again, some of the more recent music that we have. Let's go to song number 22 here. Katy Perry.
Plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again. Do you ever feel paper, paper thin, like a house of cards, broken, caving in? Do you ever feel already buried deep, just being on the screens and no one seems to hear a thing? Do you know that there's still a chance for you? There's a spark in you. You just gotta ignite the light and let it shine just on the night, like a 4th of July. Baby, you're a firework. Come on, show
me. About as sophisticated as Aerosmith and Run-DMC, I know.
As you shoot across the sky.
All right, what I want you to see in these, I call these selfie anthems here. Remember the days of Bob Dylan. Remember the days of Creedence Clearwater Revival and Fortunate Son. This is music with a message, music with, the protest music of bygone ages was music that, whether it was foolhardy or sound, was calling people to adhere to some standard, and that standard of behavior was outside of themselves, right? This is just as much message music, but the message is that you are the definition of appropriate behavior. You are the definition of what is good, and the broader society needs to cater to you. And these are the anthems of our day. They're selfie anthems. I would suggest that this is every bit as much as message music as Bob Dylan was. Bob Dylan's talking about the times they are changing. Why? There's some things wrong in society, and those things are going against what's just and right and appropriate. Maybe he's reading that rightly, maybe he's reading that wrongly, but there's nonetheless a sense of objective standards out there, right? This is telling you that you are the very standard. And things need to adjust to you. And the music that has some resonance is music that follows along those lines. So we see, you know, here's Katy Perry's song Roar again. So this is coming out 2013 here. So we got the girl who's out there in the outback with the guy.
I used to bite my tongue and hold my breath, get to rock the boat and make a mess. So I said quietly, agree politely. I guess that I forgot I had a choice. I let you push me past the breaking point. I stood for nothing, so I fell for everything.
She's alone now. She'll never guide with her. You held me down, but I got up. On my own steam, by my own self, I didn't. So now she's starting to take charge of her life, right? Of course, she needs to take some clothes off to realize herself here. All right, and it's just song after song. This one, this is going to be Sarah Bareilles' song number 24.
Beautiful community, it's in love here.
Brave. She does have actually quite a voice. This is a live performance of the song here.
You can be amazing. You can turn a phrase into a weapon or a drug. You can be the outcast or be the backlash of somebody's lack of love. Or you can start speaking up. Nothing's gonna hurt you the way the words do. They settle in your skin. Kept on the inside, no sunlight, sometimes a shadow wins. But I wonder what would happen if you said what you want to say and let the words fall out. Honestly, I want to see you be brave. What you want to say and let the words fall out. Honestly,
get the point. It's really similar to Katy Perry's Firework. I hope you see this. I call these again selfie anthems. And of course, you want people to speak up. But again, I hope you recognize the different feel or vibe between the speak up, speak out music from the Bob Dylan era versus the speak up, speak out music of the selfie era here. The standard of what's right and wrong, again, you're not calling out someone to live up to a standard, whether you're reading it right or wrong. You're calling out someone to just recognize yourself as the standard. You are the definition of what is good, what is right, and so forth. And it just goes on and on here. Rachel Platten, her 2015 song,
like a
song number 25 here.
On the ocean, sending big waves into motion, like how a thing works, make a heart open. I might only have one man, but I can take an ocean. And all those things I didn't say, wrecking ball inside my brain. I was screaming over happiness. Can you hear my voice? The sound, this is my fight song. Take back my life song. To the moonlight song.
What's she fighting for?
Not that word, tired now. Something right now, I'll be.
This is her fight song. She is just plucking up within herself the fight because I've still got a lot of fight left in me. Again, back in the 1960s, sometimes it was foolhardy, but they were fighting. So I hope you see then that the messaging today is fitting this postmodern age. And so I'm going to show you Taylor Swift. She's the next one queued up. But if you remember the long tail, names like Katy Perry. Katy Perry is about, you know, she's oh so 6 years ago. Taylor Swift is oh so 2 years ago. In fact, if you talk about Katy Perry to kids today, they'll talk about it as oldies because it was like 7-8 years ago when she was big. Taylor Swift is one of the prominent artists today, but to be the number one today does not mean that everyone looks upon you as a point of reference in the way that being number one in April of 1965, when the Beatles put out a number one song, the infrastructure of cultural experience meant that everyone was tuned into it. Not that everyone necessarily liked the Beatles, but that was the option on offer. Today, there are so many options on offer that Taylor Swift, who might be the bestseller represents such a smaller slice of the pie than what it used to be because of that long tail. But the things that do become hits today are the selfie anthems. And so here we go. This one's got kind of 3-4 things.
Come to us, s'il te
plaît.
Tu en fais vraiment trop.
This is number 26 in your handout.
Et devant nos filles, en plus. Nos filles, en plus.
She's got a spat with a boyfriend.
Calme-toi, s'il te plaît.
Je suis calme.
I promise that you'll never find another like me. I know that I'm a handful, baby. No, I never think before I talk. You're the kind of guy that ladies want. And nothing like cool shit out there. I know that I'm a psycho on the phone. I never leave well enough alone. Trouble's gonna follow where I go. And there's a lot of cool shit out there. I wanna find another like me.
You'll never find another like me.
I'm the only one of me. Baby, that's the fun of me.
I'm the only one of me. Why is that great? Because I'm the only one of me.
Like,
I know I tend to make it about me. I know you never get just what you see, but I will never fall you, baby.
And then we had to fight out in the rain. You went after me and called my name.
I never wanna see you walk away. Cause one of these things is not like the other. Living in winter, I am your lover. Every dog when it comes to a lover. I promise that you'll never find another like me.
All right, so there's enough of Taylor Swift. Can you get enough of Taylor Swift?
Yes.
I wanted to project that up there. Oh, let's see. Oh, we lost something here. I wanted to show you another slide here just to bring this. I lost it with my... Excellent. With this one, this is... This is fascinating. If we move to political science here, this is a sign of, once again, being in the postmodern world. Back in the election of, you know, this is before COVID, but the election of 2020. Remember that we had an election last year, presidential election, Biden versus Trump? Some sociologists did a fascinating study and polled people. And in this poll, they asked, okay, so who do you prefer in the upcoming election, Biden or Trump? And then tell me about your friend group. And most people who were voting for Biden hardly knew anyone who was voting for Trump. Most people who were voting for Trump hardly knew anyone within their group of social connections that was voting for Biden. Anyway, that's what, I mean, I won't go through the detail of the graphs here, but like Biden supporters, they hardly know any Trump voters. It shows that we inhabit our little niche space here, and our young people are inhabiting that niche space again. That's why we can't have a Beatlemania again. Because the mainstream is a shared place of cultural experience, for better or for worse. Mainstream can be good or bad, but we're losing a sense of mainstream, and everything is niche now. And the things that actually wind up getting some purchase, and I would say not mainstream, but crossing most people's attention, are things that have the messaging is that you are the definition of reality, and you are the center of the highest experience. The selfie. We live in a selfie world, and that is the world of postmodernity. So some thoughts for parenting in light of this. Now the motors of innovation still work somewhat, but it's not mainstream and margins anymore. It's the innovation comes from finding the next niche thing and the next niche thing. And crossovers still happen, but it's crossovers between niches. And cross-pollination between different little tribal interests becomes the source of intrigue and interest to know that's the edgy thing, right? So you're not going to the margins and pulling it into the mainstream like how rap came into the mainstream in the 1980s. It's not working like that, but little crossovers are working. Now, if you sit down with your kids and talk about and frame a conversation like what kids are into these days, that's mainstream speak, and they won't know what you're talking about. And you'll seem so left out. if you present to them, there's what kids are doing these days, because their exposure is what they are doing, your son or what your daughter is doing these days, not what the kids are doing these days. Right? That's not how to frame the conversation. And that's not how to understand your kids either. So come alongside them. I also would suggest to you a number of things about parenting. I have some ideas in our conversation in Q&A. You might have some brainstorming about this too. But with regard to these devices here, I'm not a prohibitionist. In fact, I think that if you adopt a hardline prohibitionist outlook on any of this, then you're going to lose your kids because they live in a world that functions in a certain way. You need to just come alongside them, let them experience some of the world while you are cultivating a relationship with them so that they listen to and are with you in the coaching. Okay? And that also, of course, includes age propriety. I would urge you to train your kids up to adopt technology only after they have learned to perform the function without it. Only if they have learned to perform the function without it. They should have learned to communicate verbally before they adopt a device and utilize a device to communicate electronically. Personal face-to-face, you know, the technology should be something that makes it easier to perform a function that they already know how to perform, so that it becomes a tool rather than the way of life that they're adapting themselves to. They are forming themselves, and then they adopt a tool to do that thing better. It's a very different orientation. So think about that. Just some practicalities about that. So with all the little kids you have here, I would encourage you to force your kids to actually deal with other people. Actually deal with other people. Do you raise your kids to deal with other people? Here's a good principle here at church. This could be actually a weekly thing. Okay, son might be 6 years old, son might be 12 years old. You know, every Sunday you are going to initiate a conversation with an adult. Or how about you're going to introduce yourself to an adult that you haven't talked to yet. Every Sunday you're going to have to do that with another adult. Can they do that? Are you training your children to come into a world where they can actually do that? Or you're training them to become the Christian equivalent of the people who don't even know how to offer a romantic approach to a woman. Okay? Just normal interpersonal dealings, basic life skills. If your kid is, say, in seventh grade and they're at school, and there's some confusion over the assignment, hold yourself back. The kid should ask the teacher. Do not ask the teacher yourself. Don't step in. Make the kid do it. Would the kid get it right? Maybe the kid might misinterpret. Well, how are they going to learn? Have the kid talk to the teacher rather than you talk to the teacher. You're passing through the store at point of purchase when your kid is 11 or 12. Okay, you got this one. Step back and have the kid broker this point of purchase there at the store. And learn how to have actual human interaction. And then talk about how that human interaction played out. Right? You're going, again, back at school. Here's another scenario. So the family's going out of town. Maybe it's going to be a three-day weekend. And so Judy is going to miss class on Friday because it's a three-day weekend or something like that, right? And so Judy needs to contact the teacher about that rather than you contacting the teacher about that. You might want to come in behind saying, yeah, she's not lying. I mean, we are going out of town. But but make, you know, to offer the sort of, you know, the authorized, the accreditation of the message, but then make seventh grade Judy find out what's expected. Do you think she might get it wrong? Maybe she might not understand it particularly well. Maybe she might lose the handout. You lost the handout, Judy. What are you going to do about it? You're going to have to talk to your teacher about the fact that you lost the handout. Okay. Don't stop your kids from understanding real people in the real world. Get out of their way. And this is parenting. And then talk to them about how it went. So your teacher expected you to have that done when you got back and you lost the paper. You're going to have to talk to your teacher about what you need to do now. I don't know what you need to do. And make Judy feel that. Okay. Video games. Video games. A friend of mine has a rule with video games in his home, and I think this is a really good one, where he allows his kids to play video games only if they're playing it with a friend or a family member or someone else. It basically becomes kind of like a board game or a social interaction or something like that. And there are certain video games they don't let into the house, but if you can have, you know, your two sisters playing the video game with you, then it's the kids playing a game together. It just happens to be on a video console, right? And it functions socially like a board game. You know what I mean? What you don't want to do is the kid just playing the video game and playing against the computer. Okay? Where the computer is my opponent and I'm just sucked into the rat hole of my own self-absorbed experience. You can't find someone else to play with you? Then you don't play. You're not playing. Yep, that's the way it works. I thought that was a really good rule for video games. I know a family who's with our kids. We let them have the phone. It accompanied the driver's license, and we wanted to kind of stay in touch with the kids when the kids are driving, that sort of thing. But there's a family in our church. I think it's a great idea where just gave them a cell phone, a dumb phone. It's a phone and only a phone, only a phone. And it scratches that itch. And then the iPhone can come later, and you need to be able to talk about it. I would encourage you to let your kids have iPhones before they're out of the house, so that you can coach them in that. Your little ones should live in a totalitarian police state, and as they get older, you want to give more responsibility and more privilege, more responsibility, more privilege, more responsibility, more privilege. I remember talking with our eldest son. By the time he was driving and would hang out with friends, we would never say no to a movie. Like which movie? We might say no to a circumstance, but we wouldn't say no based on the movie. You'd say, that's your call, and you're going to tell us about it afterwards. And we would make sure, and it becomes part of the banter. Was that a good movie? How did that play out? Goodness, and a few years later, he's going to be making those choices anyway. So have him make some of those choices beforehand and walk them through it. And they're going to make some bad choices. You have to let them make some of those bad choices. I remember one of the harder things, and this is when our girls were 18 and 19. This, something similar happened with two of our girls, and our daughter Maddie was a horrible driver. And she still is. So 18 and 19, they still lived at home. They had a number of things going, but getting together with some girlfriends for a weekend getaway out of town overnight. That was the proposal to us. Okay, so we're going to go up to Spokane. We're going to stay at this friend's house, and then we're going to get this hotel room, and then come back. And we wanted to know all the details about it. And Brenda and I prayed, but we thought, okay, yes, Brenda didn't want him to go. I kind of didn't want him, like, this doesn't, it's because my daughter going out with some friends, she's 19. I needed to let her do it. And what was so fascinating about it is when I said yes, and I want to know all the details, it's sort of like, oh, responsibility sets in. I can go. I'm going to be here at this time, here at that time. We're staying with these people. I get all this information now because the privilege is conferred. Anyway, there was an incident like that where one of my daughters, this was like an all-day trip. It was out of town, but just out for the day and back, kind of on a hiking thing. And they ran out of gas. It was the coolest thing. Yeah, I didn't plan that one pretty well. And they learned about life, and we talked about it. And I mean, they didn't die. They ran out of gas, and they had to figure it out, right? That was a good experience. If your kids don't have a, like, I ran out of gas kind of experience, before they leave home, what are you preparing them for? So coming back to this Proverbs 7 ideal of Solomon coming along, one of the biggest counters to the selfie culture is to be sure that you actually expose your kids to the world. And, you know, in the right kind of way, under your curation, and your curatorial hand is much heavier the younger they are, and then your curatorial hand lightens as they get older, and you're constantly having conversations with them. So, and many of my conversations with my kids that were some of the most fruitful were conversations I had with them where the answer was, yes, you can do it. Okay, I'm going to let you do it. Now tell me what the plan is. And then it takes the edge off, and they get hyper-diligent because they also know that they're going to have to answer for whatever does happen when it plays out, right? Because they know that there's going to be a conversation afterwards. And let your kids struggle a little bit. If you want your kids to own the faith, of course we want our kids to own the faith, right? Well, do you ever give them enough line to actually wrestle with a hard question on their own? And let the question fester a little bit, just like hard and challenging situations, you know, before they leave your home. Because they're going to wrestle with things after they leave your home, aren't they? So do they get any wrestling practice and wise counsel while they're in your home? So think about that, and the conversations that you can have with them are conversations that start with, okay, what's the vision of the good life in this advertisement? Where are we now? What's this technology doing for you? What, you know, why is Taylor Swift popular? Why? I mean, that's a great question, which is a different question than, is this a good song or a bad song? Which is oftentimes what we reduce to. That's usually a lame question that's uninteresting. Why is Taylor Swift popular? That's an interesting question. That you can have, and I've tried to give you some traction to answer that particular question. There are other kinds of questions that arise. Train your kids actually to even raise those questions. Is your child have a healthy kind of curiosity that's going to ferret out the sort of answers that they need, raising questions that they're going to confront? I'll tell you that this has been true of my kids. I don't know what my kids are going to face in 10 years. You don't know what your kids are going to face in 10 years. You need to train up your kids to face things then. You prepare them to face things in 10 years by preparing them to face things in general. We can talk more about, you know, the practicalities of doing that, but I would encourage you to just engage with your kids, understand where they are, and help them to understand and ask questions about, where am I in this culture? Why are people doing what they're doing? Why are people listening to that? Which is different than, is it good or is it bad? Sometimes that's an even more insightful question. Why are people listening to that, good or bad? You know, and talk about those things. And wrestle with those things. All right. With that, I'm going to leave it there with some thoughts about parenting. And then with our remaining time, I'd like to just spend with questions and conversation.
I just wanted to touch on, you talked yesterday about masculinity and femininity and mentioned that it couldn't be defined in isolation.
Right.
Could you elaborate a little bit on your thoughts on what those things mean?
Masculinity and femininity, great question. And certainly today that's a very important question because we live in an age of gender confusion. I actually introduced that. I think we instinctively know that we can't say things like, pants are masculine. There's feminine pants, there's masculine pants. How do we read through that? And how do we navigate through that? I'll jump back and talk about the nature of masculinity and femininity. Oftentimes Christians, in response to the confusions of the day, fall into other kinds of confusions that I think tend to be rather wooden on this point. I think masculinity and femininity are pretty complicated. I'll start with distinguishing between sex and gender. Sex and gender. Sex is biological. It starts with linguistic, but gender is cultural. Gender is cultural. Okay, sex is biological. Gender is cultural. And culture has to do with the meanings that we attach to certain things, the meanings that we attach to different kinds of things. And so masculinity and femininity, or maleness or femaleness, when I put the "ness" there, those are gender terms. Man, woman, male, female, those are biological terms. Male, there are two sexes. Male and female. God made them male and female. Okay? But then there is something culturally that that has to do with our self-presentation to other people in the vocabulary that other people recognize that tell a story about the givenness of creation. So the givenness is there's male and female. God made them male and female. And then we want to tell a faithful story about male and female, and that's masculine. And so I wear a shirt like this because it communicates to you something about me. It's a form of storytelling about reality. Okay, and I see, the ladies here. So here, you've got your hair pulled back in a ponytail. All right, Rachel's hair there. Look at that, and it is feminine. It's feminine, right? So the way she arranges her hair tells a story about something that is given in creation. So the biological reality is that these two people are females. I'm a male. That's the biological reality. And then the faithful person acts in culture to storytell about a true story about the world. It's possible for there to be a feminine male, right? And if that's possible, if we all agree that that's possible, to have an effeminate guy, then you know that there's a difference between sex and gender, right? What do I mean when I talk about a man behaving effeminately? If sex and gender are the same thing, then that's a nonsense expression. No, by definition, he's masculine. Everything he does is masculine. No, he can present himself. He can tell a story that lies about creation. And so an effeminate male lies about creation. Okay. So when you think of gender, actually think of language and linguistic categories. It's a cultural form. And gender can play out differently in different cultures. There are things that I can wear here in the United States that would send a signal that's like, oh, that's kind of effeminate. But in the Islamic world, in Saudi Arabia, that's clearly masculine attire, right? So there's a cultural vocabulary too. Just like, in Spanish, this thing is mano, and in English it's hand. Well, which one is right? Is it mano or is it hand? I think we know that. No, it's sort of culturally determined. And God has given human beings as His image bearers the power to actually create, the creative power. Remember in the garden, whatever Adam named it, that was its name. Okay? God has given human beings that power of storytelling, and it's up to us. If we're going to have a healthy culture, we're going to tell a culture one to another that says, you know, you've got the realities of biological male and female. Then we'll develop a cultural vocabulary that tells a story that this is a female and she's dressed femininely. And this is a male, so he's going to dress masculinely. He's going to carry himself like a man versus this person is going to carry herself like a woman. But that's the dance of cultural communication and participation. Does that make sense here? So the question then is, what is masculinity? What is femininity? How would I define them? Okay. They are cultural forms of communication about the biological reality of the differences between men and women. That's what masculinity and femininity are. And you want your kids to be good storytellers, and so your daughters should tell a story about themselves and about the creation that God put them in. So they should be in their dresses, and they should and they should have their hair like women, that sort of thing. And so with your boys, and they should interact with one another, doing that dance of masculine, feminine, too, telling a story about the givenness of reality. Yeah, now that's a great question. One of the signs of the corruption of our culture is that we are eroding the vocabulary that allows us to tell a story about masculinity and femininity, where we have unisex and androgynous clothing, where, you know, well, is this a boy or a girl walking by? That kind of thing. Coming back to, if you remember, back to the 1940s in wartime, it was interesting. You wind up with something that can be a little bit confusing. A woman turning a wrench or wielding a rivet on the Boeing assembly line in Seattle, Washington. Okay? And so what does she do? She finds some other vocabulary to make it unambiguous that she's a woman. Searches some other vocabulary because she's performing that function, right? So there was I was suggesting there was not gender confusion in the 1940s, even though we have activities that are different. And it has to do with storytelling. It's all about storytelling. And have your kids read stories. And by reading stories, I mean that in the broadest sense of read the culture around them and the story that it's telling. This is telling a story that there's no difference between men and women. That article of clothing, is that a good story? Is that a faithful story? How are you going to tell a story that reflects reality? With your demeanor, with how you act, with your clothing, and other things. And train your kids into that. And train them to look around and just notice these things. And you'll have them notice, if, you know, masculine women. And you'll have them notice effeminate men, right? Which are people who are lying about reality. They're bad storytellers. They're false storytellers, right? So that's the way it plays out. We can see that it's interesting, you know, culturally determined. Like, for example, Paul appeals to nature when he's pointing to hair. Okay, doesn't nature itself tell you that long hair is a glory to a woman and yet a shame to a man, right? And he's appealing to nature. So how long is long? Well, I reach into my pocket and I pull out a nickel and here's Thomas Jefferson with a ponytail. Right there in your pocket change. Thomas Jefferson's got a ponytail. Well, within the 18th century, it was unambiguous as to whether or not that hair, actually that was short hair in his context, whereas Elvis Presley had long hair in 1954. So there can be cultural change and difference. I can wear attire that would make me look masculine in a Muslim world that, by the way, is not confused about the difference between men and women like we are. The Muslim world is not confused on these points. And if I there are certain masculine forms of dress that I could wear that here in the United States would make me look feminine, right? And so context matters. Context always matters. And have your kids learn how to read the story that's being told. So hopefully, I mean, that's a long answer because I think you asked a really great question. It's an important thing to develop and to reflect upon. And I hope that that helps get some traction into it. So, and it's as easy as storytelling, which kind of gets complicated and messy.
This is Tyler up in the balcony with a question.
Yeah.
With the increasing selfie anthem culture that you mentioned, how should the church respond to it? I mean, it seems like that a lot of the modern church is falling into the selfie anthem curation of church to the individual. And that just doesn't seem appropriate or biblical at all. Would you agree with me on that? And what can the church do about that?
In fact, one of the... I certainly agree with the premise of the question. And one of the chief exhibits that supports the premise behind your question, if I could just comment on the question first before answering it, is this last year where, you know, how did we get into an environment where people would actually think that they can be alone going to church? How in the, what sort of prerequisite assumption and the infrastructure of society and dealing with other people, you know, the fact that that's an easy sell, that became by and large an easy sell, is remarkable, is really remarkable. And I think that that begins to lean toward what I would suggest as a response to it, which is to basically have your kids actually dealing with other people. Really, like, have their dealings, their affections, their sensibilities shaped by actual real-world encounters with actual real-world people. Another thing I noticed at New St. Andrews College, it didn't used to be this way. Rose, when you were there, it wasn't this way. But now because times have changed, and when Matt was my student and so forth, but now if you sit down and ask our students, some of our students, some of whom are in this congregation here, delightful, they're not here, they're studying back and I'm not teaching them. These delightful students, I'll sit them down and I'll ask, you know, tell me about your best friend growing up. Over half of them, I would suggest over half, I haven't done this scientifically, but my hunch is it would be over half of them would identify someone who lived in a different town that they interacted with primarily online through tutorial services and that sort of thing. I think it would be a small, it would be a majority, not a huge majority, but their best friend growing up with someone that is from another town because they had several classes together through Christian tutorial online streaming services. That's just interesting, right? Now, is that right? Is that wrong? I don't think that's right or wrong, but it's a thing, Ben. It's a thing that I would suggest conscientious parents are compensating for, recognizing that it's a thing. And so you need to be fortifying your kids. If you're a homeschooler that's using online streaming services, I don't have any objection to that. I'm just saying, eyes wide open, mark out the costs and the benefits. And there are benefits to that, and there are costs. Are you aware of the costs? Are you addressing that, or is your kid just having far more screen time than human time? You know, to shape your social relationship, and just ask that question. So Tyler's good question, I think, basically has that as the answer. I don't think that your kid in front of the screen in a homeschool tutorial kind of thing is wrong. It's sin. No. No. But it is shaping them. Eyes wide open. It is shaping them. What are you doing about that, parents? What are you? And you're responsible to understand that kind of shaping. And so are you doubling down in other ways? Remember when the women were on the women cheerleaders who doubled down. I don't think your daughter should dress like an Oregon cheerleader, okay? Right? But they were, there was a compensation recognizing, you know, okay, there's a cost to me being in this workspace here, and I need to double down and compensate for it. That's a healthy reaction. And parents, I think, need to be knowing that this is the environment that our kids are in. So that's why I say, you know, let your kids talk to adults. Make them talk to adults. Make them, when they're 12, step back. Make them be that weird parent who actually gives the checkbook to your kid with your signature on it. No one uses checkbooks anymore anyway. But or gives the credit card to them and has the kid manipulate the credit card there as you're going through Winco or Top Foods or whatever it is, buying the groceries. And that actually helps to answer, I think, some of those problems. So, and there's a lot more to that. I've tried to give some practicalities. Maybe some others have good ideas too. Okay. Yeah, there's questions over there, over there, over there. There we go. Mm-hmm.
Right. We talked about last night about how, like, the Leave It to Beaver days compared to, like, say, the 70s, the Brady Bunch days, and then obviously
right.
Where we're at now. The question is, does culture shift and change when it comes to moral right and wrong based on culture's opinion of what's right and wrong or the moral conscience before the accountability we have before God? So who decides what shifts American culture? Obviously, the church should never shift right. Because we know it's a conscience thing before God we're accountable to.
Right.
But the non-Christian or just a, you know, secularist worldview, is it the culture that decides? And the reason why I'm asking is, look how fast things have changed just in the last 10 years.
Right.
And then what is the next 10 years going to look like?
Well, there's, if I could parse the question, and maybe that, if I... I hear your question as an ambiguous one. If you're asking how does it work, then I can answer how does it work, and the culture changes itself by certain motors of causation that I've been describing. How should it change is a different question than how does it change. But it should change, of course, to increasingly grow in its glorification of the Most High God whom we worship, in the triune God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's what it should be doing. But how does it change? It changes as human beings are in that culture, human beings who are, if we want culture to glorify God, we understand how culture works and how human beings work, how God created us and we're faithful to Him, and then we can permeate the culture that God has given us. Sometimes that means utilizing some of the things that are out there and available. Sometimes that means subverting some of the things that are out there and available. And that's the Christian life. We're subverting some things that are around us, and we're deploying some things that are around us and appropriating them. And we want to train up our children to do the same thing. Okay. And so I've tried to talk about how culture works today. It works in certain ways like it was working 50 years ago, but then it's morphed over the last 20 years from modernity to postmodernity. And some of those modern things have penetrated through into postmodernity, right? But postmodernity has put a new twist in it, you know. And so we need to understand that. Some of those forces, I think, need to be appropriated, others subverted, as we're faithful people operating within it. So...
So in relation to the kind of analyzing or critiquing culture with your kids,
or just as an adult. How can we do that and train our kids to do that without it turning into a very snobby thing?
That's a great question.
How can we teach them to not have pride in that? How can we teach them to have a soft heart that realizes that they have sin in their heart? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think asking the question is probably, 98% of answering, like, they can't be snobby here. Actually, you and I were talking about this. What's your name again? Sorry. Ben. So Ben and I were actually talking about, Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best or Brady Bunch or something like that, which is very different than the sitcoms of today. And he shows those to his kids. My advice to Ben yesterday was that you need to teach them to interrogate those kinds of things. Show them to your kids. That's fine, and enjoy them and laugh at them. It's fine for you to watch Leave It to Beaver. But then ask, does your mom really look like June Cleaver? I mean, seriously, tea dress and pumps all the time. Really? And what does she do? And I would seriously enjoy watching Leave It to Beaver with your 8-year-old and then say, what does this woman do? And turn that into something that's kind of, it's fun, levity, joke, kind of make fun of it, and then show them Taylor Swift. What does this mean? Katy Perry, baby, you're a firework. And I think you should laugh at Katy Perry a little bit, just like you should laugh at June Cleaver. Okay. But then there's a temptation on the other side. The flip side, and I think one of the best things we can do to avoid pride is to have them also laugh at themselves and not be self-serious and to interrogate themselves like they're interrogating this TV show. Now, how that plays out, it's one thing for me to say that, and that's a nice platitude, laugh at yourself and don't be self-serious. But in the art of it, you should take the lead in that. What idiotic thing I did today? I actually went through the stupid rabbit hole of watching, there was a YouTube video that was helpful, but then it signaled to another one to me. I watched that and I wasted 10 minutes. Do you ever say that in front of your kids? You should. You should. Then that models to them how you want them to be, as that you want them to have eyes to see, but they also need to have, before God, the eyes to see themselves in this narrative too. And I think I love that question because you're absolutely right. You can develop the Pharisaical kid who says, oh, thank you, God, for not making me like this poor sap that I'm laughing at and making fun of. And watch out for that temptation. I thank you for calling attention to it.
Yesterday, you kind of started your talk, I think, with what the family was like pre-industrial age.
Right.
Everyone's working out of home, mm-hmm. kind of an idea, and then everyone was parsed out to their roles outside
right.
of the home, industrial age,
yep.
Suburbs, and so on and so forth. So I'm curious, since how we can't undo the industrial revolution per se, what does that mean as far as if you were proposing that was part of something that showed problems or creates problems within a family unit, then what's going the other direction look like?
Well, yeah, that's a good question too. So I talked about the problems of the industrialized family. Remember also my remarks about my resistance to elevating Golden Age, so I don't want to suggest that the pre-industrial agrarian family was some ideal that we should try to revert back to. I don't think that the goal is to undo the industrial revolution. It's just sort of a thing, right? And so coming back to what I was saying about postmodernity, sort of here we are, here we live in a world of iPhones and long tails where there is no mainstream. Okay? So what are the opportunities and what are the temptations of that world? How can I be aware of the temptations, resist them? How can I succeed and grow in creative ways and imagine better ways of life? And that sort of thing. So I'm not trying to undo the Industrial Revolution. If that were the case, then, you know, I wouldn't be here at this conference. I was able to drive in my automobile from Idaho to here to be here with you, and I'll be driving back home tomorrow. I'm thankful for the Industrial Revolution, but it came with consequences and trade-offs. So, yeah, and just have eyes wide open with the trade-offs. So, does that help get it, what you're talking about? I think there might have been more to your question here. Yeah. Right. Yeah, understand the age that you're in, because temptations will always manifest themselves, never abstractly. Temptations show up in a presentation of some actual thing that's right in front of you right now, that actual thing inhabits space and time. It always does. And so understand your space and time and be faithful in it. And I would suggest that, you know, the world of Thomas Jefferson in 1800, sort of pre-industrial, had a lot of temptations and problems there. And if I were a guy who was living at that time, I'd probably describe and characterize it a little differently, because we need to read the signs of those times as opposed to the signs of our times. So, and part of my whole project here is to train up your children to read the times, and to understand their own times so that things don't sneak up on them. So things don't sneak up on them. Yes? That's right. Someone raised, I see the hand raised with the person with the microphone. Yeah, go ahead.
So it's interesting. One thing to think about is what is our responsibility and how we train our kids to be in this culture that they are in. But we also seem to have the ability to create a church culture or a counterculture. Mm-hmm. Like I think of our school, we're creating a school culture that is different. We just walked away from their school culture and created our own. And so what place does that have to play and how do we balance that? Because I also think of like Christian rock culture, and it's like we don't have a Bob Dylan or a Beatles. Like it's just so much different or better in a lot of ways. So how do we interplay that? Like, are we supposed to be creating our own culture and walk away from this? Or is it more equipping them to be in that culture?
That's a really good question. Excuse me, it's a both and. You want your kids to always create culture. If you want them to become, you know, mothers, fathers, if you want them to become people of affairs in the world of commerce and business, and people who are in the church, leading in the church, all these little ones, imagine, you know, fast forward 20 years, there they are. They are making and forming culture. They are and you want to train them to do that. Which is one of the reasons why you need to show them how culture works, so they could know how to do that in their context. But also, you know, no man is an island. I played Simon and Garfunkel, and this, I'm a rock, I'm an island, the rock feels no pain, you know, which is not true. God places us into a context, and as the kingdom advances, it's encroaching upon the world that we're always brushing up against, too. And what's successful and what's opportune is shaped by the fact that God put us into this context, too. So we are affected by the wider culture, and we need to understand that, but we are also supposed to be shaping culture for ourselves. And that includes developing a church culture and a family culture. And, you know, if you're a businessman, sort of, a business environment culture, in whatever wake that you leave a Christian wake, God puts unique promises upon the family and upon the church. Those are divine institutions. It's not said about anything else, you know, any other institution, that the gates of Hades won't prevail against this, against the church. And God's given children to the family, mothers and fathers, and that's where children, so there's opportunities that God gives to the family that he doesn't give to business, that he doesn't give to certain other things, right? And we need to be forming those cultures, and those become the things that win our kids' hearts and affections and their discernment to help them as they go encounter the culture that has more shaping influence on them so that they can navigate it. So it's, yes, we should be building a culture so that kids can come into the church and be within the church and have their sensibilities trained so then that they can expand the kingdom in a world that's got other sensibilities than the church.
So. Sean's going to get last question, and then I'm sure our speaker would be happy to entertain additional questions up front. But just in the interest of time, Sean gets the last group question.
So how would you say we can, interject or inject into our conversations with our kids about culture, their own sin, and redemption, Christ's work for them on their behalf, and kind of keeping Jesus at the center of those conversations when we're looking at culture?
Yeah, I think it's, coming back to the Shema, when you sit at home, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. So, hey, son, what are you doing? It usually starts with that. What are you doing? Oh, I'm doing this. What's going on? Tell me about that. And show genuine interest. Explain that to me. Listen to, what music do you listen to? Your kids should share their Spotify list with you. If you've got, a teenager with a Spotify list, your 4-year-old's not going to have a Spotify list. But you should share that Spotify list, and then you should, put it on when you're driving together in the car. Let's have your playlist now. What do you like about this song? Why? Why is this one on the list? Where does it come from? Oh, this reminds me of something that I know. And you just have natural conversations, and be thoughtful and reflective about that. It's interesting how ineffective sort of, conjured up staged teaching moments are as a parent. If I can draw an analogy, if you're a parent, you've gone on vacation or something, right? You plan, okay, we're going to go camping and we're going to have a great time, or we're going to go to this other city, visit this other city, see these amusements. And you have certain things in your mind and your imagination that, we're planning this activity because the kids will think that this is fun, right? Doesn't it always happen that as you're talking about it ahead of time, the thing that the kid really loved was the fact that you stopped at a convenience store to use the bathroom and got this thing of bottle caps or something, and then it's always that way. The thing that resonated with them is never what you had planned to resonate with them, right? It's always that way. And so I think that rule applies to the really good question you're asking, which is, how do we have these teaching moments with your kids? It never works to try to stage the teaching moment like you stage and plan that vacation. Okay. The teaching moments actually come along the way when you stop at the convenience store to pee, and something else. And that's actually when it happens. And so be involved with your kids. Be involved with your kids so that those moments arise a lot. Okay, rather than trying to stage the teaching moment. Okay, because it never works. You're always going to be disappointed. It's never, really? you thought that was the fun thing? I mean, I spent all this money to go to this hotel and to pay for the amusement park, and the fun thing for you was the bottle cap at the convenience store. I could have saved a lot of money. My kids are grown, you know, when they all get together and they talk about memories of childhood, it's so amazing to hear them talk about their childhood and learn the like what stuck out to them. And it's never what you as a parent in the moment are thinking is sticking out to them, right? So just understand that rule. And if you've been parenting for a while and your kids have reached any sort of age, even if they're still in the home, you know, if they're old enough so that there's any retrospect, you know, like a 10-year-old, sometimes you'll see this. And what you had planned to resonate didn't. When you keep that in mind, then it's always got to be happening. And it just needs to be a lifestyle rather than a special technique. And if you reduce it to a technique, then it's not going to work. It just needs to be natural and out of your fingertips. So, anyway, good question.
Let's give Dr. Schlecht a hand.